One of the things that has motivated a lot of researchers that are interested in observational learning are concerns over things like television violence. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is actually, despite the fact that television makes a huge amount of money, a large amount of research has actually necessitated and forced the putting of various warnings, categorizations, classifications of television, right? This is, safe for children, this should not be viewed by young children. So there are rating systems that have been applied to television programming in various countries. So we have got some interesting things coming out of that. Now, probably the largest study, although I guess I should say, interestingly enough, despite this, there are still a number of people that argue that, in fact, viewing acts of violence on television have no effect whatsoever on people, despite the fact that research doesn't actually support that. There have been hundreds, thousands, really, of studies on the effect of television on people's behaviors. Many of these are directed at the effects on children, others at adults. One of the largest studies that was done was the National Television Violence Study, published in 1998. It was a three-year study. They actually observed 8,000 hours of television programming, 7 days across the entire week, airing from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Now, obviously, you're leaving out very late night and very early television programming, but the reason for the 6 to 11 was they were primarily interested in its effects on children. And their argument is the vast majority of children are probably not going to be watching television at 4 in the morning, so you probably don't need to be sampling from that point. If they are, we've probably got something else going on here. So there you have it. What they found was that over 60% of programs contained depictions of violence. Only about 4%, bit under 3.8 or something like that, so less than 4% contained anti-violence messages. Now, they did describe violence in a fairly liberal way. So, I mean, if you have something like the Muppets, I mean, if you have Miss Piggy smacking Kermit, I mean, this is Muppet violence, so it's puppets being aggressive to puppets. But they said, that's an act of violence. And the reasoning is, young children don't necessarily distinguish between what a Muppet is doing and what a person is doing. These are seen as equal actions. Okay, so it's like, all right, so fair enough. So a cartoon, Daffy Duck blows up Elmer Fudd. It's like, yeah, that's an act. It's just a cartoon. It's like, yeah, but again, young children don't necessarily distinguish what's happening in the cartoon from what happens in reality. The lines get very, very blurry. What they found was based on their projections, by age 12, the average American child will have seen 8,000 murders on television, or at least events that would produce death. So like Daffy Duck blowing up Elmer Fudd, Elmer Fudd walks away from it, but he really shouldn't, and over 100,000 other acts of violence on TV. Now, some people have argued, this is an argument that is not uncommonly made by television executives and lobby groups for television, have said, look, you can't bitch and complain about the television that is depicted on violence. All television does is reflect what is happening in society. It is a mirror for society. If you want there to be less violence on television, then work on society first and clean it up. All right. Fair enough. How many individuals, just pick you guys, by age 12, had personally witnessed 8,000 murders? A 1,000 murders? 500? I mean, you've pretty much got to be living in a war zone. And there are parts of the world where this happens, right? But, I mean, North America? No. This is not actually a direct representation of reality. It's a model of reality, if you will. We've talked about models. They don't have to be accurate. They just need to represent. So it's a very broad representation at best. So that argument that this is just a depiction of what's really happening in society seems to be rather false. I mean, you know, 8,000 murders in 12 years, you'd pretty much have to be coming back from school every other day and stumbling over a corpse. Probably pretty unlikely. Unless your bus driver is really angry and just randomly shoots people as he drives by. So, no, this is not representative in a sense. All right. And yeah, as I said, despite this, we still have people say, no effect. One thing I should say here is that, and we've discussed this before, we've discussed the idea that correlation is not causation. Okay, so one of the things that is commonly found in a lot of research is children that are exposed to more violence during with television programming grow up to be more aggressive and violent in real life. This is a correlation. Okay? We don't know what the causative factor is here, but we have a correlation. Now, to give you an idea, the correlation here, correlations can be positive or negative. So a positive correlation says if we have a lot of this, then we will have a lot of that. Negative says if we have a lot of this, we will have little of that. Okay? So, to give you an idea, the correlation between exposure to television violence and subsequent future aggressive behavior is about 0.35. Okay? So we can account for 0.35 or 35% of the variability in behavior in terms of aggressive behavior from television. Now, correlations go from negative 1 to positive 1. If you get a correlation of 1, it means, yes, we've got this much of this, and we will have that much of the other thing. Those are perfect correlations. If you have 0, it's just like, hey, it's random. So 0.35 is, you say, well, that's kind of a long ways from 1. You're only accounting for 35% of the variation there. That seems like a lot of wiggle room for something else. You know, we have other stuff going on. Fair enough. A lot of other stuff going on. Okay, the correlation for smoking and lung cancer, about 0.38. Outside of executives and CEOs that work for tobacco companies, even smokers go, yeah, I know, smoking can produce lung cancer. I probably shouldn't be doing this. Oh, well. You know that's probably bad for you?
Yeah.
Think that smoking could cause lung cancer? Yeah, I know that. 0.38. Nobody really quibbles about this. No one says, hey, you know, yeah, I've got black tarry goop in my lungs and I have cancer. I think it's probably from eating ice cream. Correlation's only 0.38, you know, it's not like 1. Like I said, aside from like tobacco executives, like, well, I don't know, it's a pretty low correlation. Nobody else really quibbles about this. It's like, yeah, I know, yeah, okay. And yet, a correlation of 0.34, 0.33 between television violence and aggression, it was like, well, we don't have all the facts there. That's a pretty low correlation. Interesting. Let's take a look at a few other correlations here. Condom use and contraction of HIV. Negative 0.18. So, in other words, the more you use condoms, the idea is the less you're likely to contract HIV. Now, I mean, the idea, the way not to catch HIV is to use condoms, right? It's like, oh yeah, it's negative 0.18. It's not really a surefire approach to things here, right? Pretty low correlation, actually, but people are like, yeah, I got that, okay? Secondary smoking and lung cancer, only about 0.15. Secondary smoking is terrible. Nope. Again, people don't generally quibble about that one too much. Lead exposure in child IQ, negative 0.15. There was an executive in China who was executed a few years back for allowing the use of lead-based paints in toys that were then bought by Walmart and sold to North American children. Because maybe they're going to stick the toy in their mouth and become idiots. So we'll shoot them. Negative 0.15. I'm not saying you should give your baby a pacifier made of lead. Yes, we have good evidence that, the consumption of leads leads to difficulties with IQ. But it's a pretty low correlation, right? A little bit of lead in your diet probably isn't going to turn you into, you know, someone with an IQ of 4. I'm not saying you should go and lick lead for the heck of it, but, calcium intake and bone mass. What's that, about 0.14? Milk, it does your body good. Build strong bones, actually, pretty weakly. It's a pretty low correlation. And you've got to deal with bioavailability. Have a calcium pill. It'll make your bones stronger. Well, only if it's actually in a bioavailable form that can be uptaken by the body, provided you have enough sunlight and the ability to get vitamin D. Still, drink more milk. We love correlations. Okay? People believe most correlations, even if they're quite weak. And yet, we find a surprising amount of resistance to watching television violence leads to aggression later in life. It's an interesting little one there. My personal favorite, homework and academic achievement. And this is about 0.12, 0.13, something like that. In other words, you know, parents are always, do your homework. You want to do well in school, do your homework. Apparently, it's a very poor correlation. Now, this doesn't help you at this point, because obviously you're adults, but I mean, imagine you had this information a few years back, and your parents were like, do your homework! Well, actually, Dad, studies have shown that there's a relatively weak correlation of only 0.12 between homework performance and future academic performance at the university level. So, frankly, I think I'm going to not do that and instead go play some Nintendo. Oh. Well, can't really argue with the numbers, so carry on, son. Right. Right, but we take it as a given, right? If you do your homework, you're going to do better in school, get better grades, get a better job. Huh. Seems to be a few other things going on. Okay. So, got a very interesting television vibe. So, why perhaps do we have... Well, one, I mean, there's a very, very strong lobby groups for television. Two, we get into the marketing. Certain demographics, age groups, actually really like to watch television programming that has violence and sex and violence. Put them all together, and then you can sell commercial time in those programs pretty easily. Sort of stuff going on there. We're humans, and so we have certain predispositions towards watching things like violence and sex and violence, and dangerous situation. It probably good survival benefits, right? I mean, you know, it's like the why do people slow down and look at a traffic, you know, collision on the highway, right? Because maybe you learn something useful, right? Observational learning, right? Whoa, what did they do? Because I don't want to be doing that. Whatever it was they did and, you know, had that collision, I need to try to avoid that. What can I learn from this? Those of our ancestors that didn't pay attention to things probably didn't survive as long. So learning by other people's misfortune, it sounds cold and cruel, but it's actually a pretty good survival benefit, right? I wonder what this lever does. Ooh, trap door into spikes. It's like, yeah, I think I'm not going to pull the lever. Okay? So, correlation. Like I said, correlation of studies. The downside with most of these studies is they are correlations. There could be something else going on. So, you know, here's sort of the question. Do individuals that, you know, that are watching violent television, do they watch violent television because, is it the violent television that makes them aggressive, or are they already aggressive and therefore they find violent television more rewarding? Which is it? Do you watch, you know, romantic comedies because you're just a fun-loving kind of person to begin with, or which one causes which? We don't know from correlations. We can't tell. The problem with correlations, right? They're not causative. There'll be something else going on entirely, right? Watch violent television and you're aggressive because you were bonked on the head with a bottle of Pepto-Bismol as a kid. Who knows? Could be something bizarre. I'm not actually seriously suggesting being bonked on the head by a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. But I'm saying there could be a third factor that's really causal, and you just get these correlations. So that's the difficulty with most of these. There could be additional factors involved. One of the things you can do to try to increase at least some of the certainty, won't give you causation yet, but you can do longitudinal studies. So you can follow people over long periods of time. So you start the study when you've got a bunch of children that are young, and then you track them, right, over the next 10, 15, 20 years, and you see which of them become mass murderers and which of them become saints. All right? Now, it's a simplification, all right? This is very different from just doing a study where you get people to, say, fill out a questionnaire about how much violent, what are your television viewing habits, and, you know, have you ever punched somebody? Well, there's actually psychometric scales you can do for aggression levels, okay? But that's like the snapshot. So yes, we find they watch a lot of violent television, and yes, they tend to get into scraps. Yeah, we don't know the causation. Longitudinal studies, we can at least say, okay, so if we've got, you know, children that are watching a lot of violent television from the time they're very, very young, again, it's not necessarily a causal factor, but we find that children that don't watch a lot of violent television when they're young turn out not to be aggressive. Seems a little more support, a little stronger. The downside with longitudinal studies is you have to follow subjects over time. So you need a pretty big sample set to begin with, because you're not going to be able to track all of your subjects, right? I mean, some are going to move away, some are just going to drop out of the study, some are going to die. So you need to have a pretty large sample to do a longitudinal study. If you want to do a longitudinal study over 20 years, you need a lot of subjects, really, to get good statistical strength there, good power. Other downsides, this is expensive. Right, you've got to like now maintain all this data on subjects. Where are they going? Please contact us if you move. Where do they go? I don't know. Let's try to find them. And it's going to take a long time to do. Right, your publication rate is going to go way down. So what have we published lately? Nothing. But 20 years from now, I'm going to have like some great stuff to publish then. Yeah, see, so those are some potential problems there with the longitudinal studies and some of the strengths. Experimental studies. This would be the ideal way to do this, right? With experimental studies we discussed, you can get causation. The downside, of course, with this is, you know, imagine we get a group of, 200 families that agree to have their kids take part in the study, and it's like, thank you for taking part. We will randomly assign your child to one of two study conditions. In the first study condition, children will be shown massive amounts of violence on television. We hypothesize that this will turn them into slathering, bloodthirsty, killing monsters as adults. The second group will receive limited amounts of television violence. We hypothesize this will lead to a much better, well-adjusted individual. Can I get my kid in group two? I'm sorry, it's a random generation of who's in which group. You're not going to get that through ethics anyways, right? But I mean, you're not going to get a lot of adults going, yes, please, put my kid in the first group. Let's turn them into somebody that's just crazy violent. Right? I've seen Clockwork Orange. I know how this works. Yeah. There's difficulties there. So a lot of these sorts of experimental studies that have been done are a bit contrived, right? You know, thank you for taking part in the study. You'll be watching a half-hour program, and then we will give you a series of questions to make some assessments. Okay. Those studies typically find, yes, if you're exposed to violent programming, you know, watch a violent half-hour program, say you do an aggression indices scale before you watch the program and then after, yes, sure enough, we generally see an increase in the score on the aggression indices after watching the violent programming. However, if you come and get people to come back in 5 or 6 days later, they're back to their baseline. Doesn't seem to last. Also, let's face it, I mean, this is pretty contrived. Please come into my lab space and watch this program. Most people don't really sit there in a lab space doing this. It's also pretty easy to figure out what the subject or what the study is about. So, right, we've got into issues with methodological design. Most people don't watch programming in labs. Okay? They do it at home, at their friend's place, go see movies, much more real world. Okay? So that becomes a little bit of an issue there. And the brief time period is kind of a biggie. Again, what we're really more interested with this is the sort of long-term effects of years and years of depiction of violence on TV to people's behaviors. Very occasionally, researchers luck out and they manage to stumble into a real-world situation that lets them do an A-B design. So, about 20 years ago now, time's flying, about 20 years past, there was a town in northern British Columbia that had not had any television up there. It was way up north, so there was no broadcast for reaching them. And then the broadcaster decided they were going to put up a tower so they could get some television. Television feed-in. Some researchers at, I think it was Simon Fraser, heard about this and rushed up to the town and got as many people in town as they could to fill out, you know, aggression indices, questionnaires, and surveys. Then they came back 2 years later, after they had 2 years of television in place, and gave them the questionnaires again. So there's your A, your baseline before television, B, after television, and found, sure enough, there was an increase in the aggression indices after 2 years of exposure to the television. But those kinds of things don't happen very often, right? You don't usually, as a researcher, luck into that kind of situation. So it's very difficult to produce good experimental, you know, believable, realistic, real-world, non-contrived experimental studies. So again, a great deal of what we have are correlational findings. But what we can say is, based on these, at least from the correlation and from perhaps the not great experimental studies because of various confounds and whatnot, and the longitudinal studies, it definitely seems the more violence people are exposed to on television, the more aggressive they will behave as adults. This fits with things like Bandura's social learning theory and his various studies on this. So observational learning can be used for good or evil. In fact, actually, what Bandura has been doing, U of A gave Bandura an honorary degree 2 years ago, I think it was. He was up here speaking. I saw him speak, Albert Bandura. He said, you know, he finds it slightly ironic. He's in his 80s now. People recognize him, like in the grocery store, you know, if you're doing intro psych or the equivalent of this course, people stop and say, oh, hey, you're that, like, Bobo the Clown guy, right? And it's like, yeah, I was 45 years ago. I've been doing some other stuff since. In fact, actually, what he's been doing since for about the last 15 years is working with a group that tries to utilize observational learning for positive social change. What they do is they work predominantly with third world countries. Now, they have to be invited in. They're an American-based organization doing this. That's where Bandura is now in the States. So they don't want to just go in and try to fix things because that's like, you know, America interfering. So they'll only come in if they're invited in by the government. But said, for example, in Mexico, they got invited in to try to see if they could do something that would improve adult literacy, problems with high adult illiteracy. What the group does is essentially makes soap operas, either for radio, depending on the country, or for television. In Mexico, they did television one. And what they do is produce, basically, in this case, a television soap opera. And one of the characters, they had various characters. They have a positive and a negative and an in-transition model. So the positive model is one who doesn't, for example, in this case, that doesn't read, is an adult that can't read, but goes to school, goes through the things, learns to read, and whose life is made better. Okay, so there's the model that shows by doing this. There's the negative, the adult that cannot read and refuses to learn to read, and then something bad happens to that adult. So there's the aversive. And then there's the in transition. So the adult that can't read and has to work the way through the process to develop this, showing the kinds of skills that one needs to do, steps to follow to get the reading and to get the benefits. And so they've done this, and they find that it has some huge effects. For example, their measure in this case was enrollment in adult literacy classes. And in the year following the soap opera that depicted this, skyrocket increase in enrollments. They've done other ones in India with respect to education for women, for example. They find again, this is a radio drama where one of the characters was a girl in a village who decided she was going to open her own school for some of the children there to give them education. And what they found was, in fact, in reality, they found in various rural villages, they had young women doing the same thing. They identified with the heroine in the program and started opening their own schools to try to teach kids some schooling. So a very interesting process. But he says what's really important here is you need the models. You need the positive exemplar, the negative, and the in transition. Bender was talking about in one of the African countries where HIV and AIDS is very high. So one of the ironic sort of issues with this, they put this on videotape. It said one of the biggest spreaders of HIV infection are the long-haul truckers. A lot of those are moved by trucks. But he said, you know, the truckers will go to the truck stops, and there's prostitutes there. And so they have sex with the prostitutes, and they contract HIV, and then they spread this throughout the prostitutes by going up and down the various trucking lines. So he said, you know, we had this issue with this. We needed then three truckers in our drama. We needed the one that was going to practice safe sex and avoid HIV and become successful. The one who was not going to practice safe sex and would contract HIV, go on a full-blown AIDS and die horribly. And then the one that realizes that perhaps he needs to start being safer and so move through transition. And he said, now, of course, in perhaps a North American audience, we'd have the positive exemplar just never has sex with prostitutes. But he said, in this culture, no one would possibly believe that truck drivers would not be having sex with prostitutes. So our positive and transitional models had less sex with prostitutes. Like you got to know your culture. You got to know your culture if you're going to do this. Anyways, you could do similar things with this with respect to violence. So depending on how you depict violence, again, your exemplars, your models, positive, negative, transitional, the same sorts of ideas of observational learning could be brought in, which would have some potentially very good societal effects. Okay. Any questions? All right. Phobias. Lots of people have phobias about something or other. Very common. Most typical phobias in people are phobias about things that have too many legs or too few legs. So creepy crawlies or snakes. I think people don't like rats because the tail looks kind of snake-like and scaly. But people don't seem to mind mice. The tails are a little bit furrier, smaller, just can't see them quite as well. We do know that a lot of phobias develop in childhood, and they seem to be vicariously acquired. So phobias often run in families. Children that display phobias, it's not uncommon, it's not a perfect correlation by any means. Again, we're dealing with correlations here, but there is a moderate positive correlation between at least one parent having that phobia, okay? Or a closely related phobia. And so it seems quite likely that parents or other relatives that are around, caregivers that are around children early on in development, demonstrate phobia, fear of something, and the children just through observational learning develop the same phobia. Okay? May never have actually experienced any problems with a spider themselves, but if mom or dad freaks out about spiders, then do the same thing. And look at, I mean, mom or dad, right? Authority figure, dominance, family member, so similar to you, right? Lots of contact, okay? From Bandura's social learning theory here, this is exactly the person, right, that young kids are probably going to imitate. Okay. So, you know, there's issues there. Now, we've talked a little bit already about phobia treatments. You can do flooding. Births in the room with lots and lots of spiders. You can do systematic desensitization, gradually expose them to spiders. Or you can utilize observational learning techniques in treatment as well. So you can use modeling. This tends to work very well with, for example, young kids. We said one of the issues with systematic desensitization is that you have to be given, for it to work really well, generally these relaxation techniques. And young kids aren't really great at doing meditative processes. So modeling becomes a good, viable option here. In fact, some studies show that it can actually be much more rapid if you use modeling than using flooding or systematic desensitization. Well, not necessarily faster than flooding, but you really don't have the negative consequences that you can potentially get with flooding, which are very real risks. But there is also evidence that modeling treatments for phobias may generalize better than a systematic desensitization. Now, there's three ways you could do this. First is called graduated modeling. With graduated modeling, you have a model. So you've got the patient that's got the phobia. You've got the therapist. Then you have a model. So let's say we've got somebody who has got a fear of heights. Okay. So in graduated modeling, you'd have the therapist in the office, the client, the patient in the office, and you'd have a model there. And maybe let's say you've got a ladder. Okay. So it's like, all right, here we go. Here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna show you how to climb a ladder. It's like, do you like climbing ladders? No, I'm afraid of heights. You know that, doc. Okay. So here I've asked Bob here to come in and demonstrate. Now, Bob, would you please step up onto the first rung of the ladder? Okay, now what I'd like you to do is notice. Bob's put both hands on the rung of the ladder. He stepped up with one foot first, then he plants the other foot. Bob, do you feel stable? Yep, doing okay. What would happen if you were to take your hands off the ladder? Bob, I'd probably fall off. So are you going to do that? No, I'm not. I'm going to keep one hand on the ladder at all times. Okay, so we do that. Now, Bob, please step up to the second rung of the ladder. Now, watch how he does this. Okay, he moves a hand up, he keeps his 2 feet, and that blah, 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 on and on with this. So you've got a model showing all the steps. Okay, and it's like, thank you, Bob, please come on down. Now, you try. So we just want you to go on to the first step of the ladder. Remember how Bob did this? I think so. Okay, give it a try. This is a fairly simplistic, right, the idea of ladders, right? But you could do this with, like, elevators or you know, whatever it happens to be. Snake charming, if you're afraid of snakes. Now, watch how the snake handler does this. Okay. Bad things happen if, like, the model actually gets hurt. So you don't want that to happen, right? Okay. Same problem with any other sort of situation. But this would be graduated modeling. So the model is going through, in a gradual process, gradual steps, the phobia. Okay? The patient observes. Now, based on, let's say, Bandura's social learning theory, what kind of model should we pick? So if we've got, I don't know, a mid-30s, mid-30s computer programmer, male computer programmer, what kind of model should we have here demonstrating working through the phobia? Somebody similar? Somebody dissimilar? Similar? Okay, probably similar. So mid-30s, similar build. Should we have, say, the best rock climber in the world depicting how to climb a ladder? No. Okay, notice how Bob, the best rock climber in the world, climbs the ladder using only his ears. Okay. Yeah, no. The more similar you can make it to your client, your patient, the better. Okay, so, yeah, exactly. Participant modeling is very similar, except in this case, instead of, in my example, having one ladder there, you have two ladders. Okay, so the model steps up onto the first rung of the ladder, and then the patient, the client, does this as well. So it's like, okay, look over at the model, see where the model's hands are. Yeah, I see, okay, put your hands in the same place on your ladder, and step up. So there's this, you go, look over. It's guided. It's like, phase 4 in the Epstein study, right, where the model bird is over on the left, and the observer bird's there on the right, and you look over, check what's going on. Okay, so you can always get that feedback. So that's called participant modeling. Now, you can do this with actual real people, or you can utilize what's called symbolic modeling. In symbolic modeling, you're not using a real person. It may be a video of a person, right? You know, well, we've done a video here of Bob climbing a ladder. Forwards, backwards, we can go back and see a step that we've already done before, okay, watch as many times as you want. It doesn't even have to be actually a person that you made. It could be a cartoon, right? It could be Mickey Mouse doing something. Even Stimpy, it doesn't really matter. It could be cartoon characters, okay? So the symbolic modeling opens things up a lot. In this case, with recent things in computer-generated avatars, there's some interesting things happening here in that, I said, ideally your model is going to be very similar to your client, to the patient. Well, with computer-generated graphics avatars, you can set a lot of these criteria really easily. You don't have to run around trying to, okay, I'm looking ideally for a 56-year-old, one-armed, South American model. Yeah, that's going to be a little bit difficult to find on short notice. No problem, we can program that. Okay. So, there's some interesting applications here for these things. As well, there's some interesting that's been happening over about the last 10 years in terms of things like virtual realities. So, you've got someone who's afraid of heights, you can put them in a VR helmet and, for example, put them in a virtual glass elevator, or a virtual airplane, or a virtual hang gliding. At no point do they actually leave the ground, but they can get that experience in a completely safe way. They can watch someone demonstrate this, and then tandem, if it's like hang gliders, watch someone do it, then tandem flight it in the virtual reality, watch somebody else go up the glass elevator in virtual, do it with them in virtual. So these are some very interesting techniques that are being brought into phobia reduction therapies now. With children as well, children are very familiar with cartoons, with animations, with computer graphics. These things can work very, very well with kids. This generation, the last generation of children, very comfortable with this sort of depiction of models. So. It's not off-putting, it's not scary, it's not unusual to them. It's just one of these sorts of things they're used to, who are willing to watch it, willing to engage with it. So these are some kind of exciting new things there. You don't have to restrict your observational learning use of models just to cases of phobias. You can utilize models in a lot of other aspects of behavioral therapy as well. So you can use models to, say, influence an observer for some behavior. Now, this might be facilitating a response that a patient already knows. Let's say we've got some patients in a mental institute, and we're trying to be nice if they could, say, do a better job of personal hygiene and keeping their rooms in order. One of the things you could do is you could slip in a ringer, right? So, hi everybody, this is Trevor. He's a new, he's going to be joining us here at the Institute. Try to make him welcome, blah, blah, blah. Trevor may actually be a therapist who is pretending to be a patient. And it's you. So Trevor models appropriate behavior. The staff then plays along. If Trevor, brushes his teeth in the morning, whatever, does his personal grooming hygiene, bam, Trevor gets that reinforcement. Okay, Trevor makes his bed, cleans up the room, boom, gets that reinforcement. Other patients can see that. And look, it's different. It's not the staff saying, you have to brush your teeth, you have to take a shower, just do it, okay? It's like, oh, I'm just, there's just some other patient that's stuck in here as well. Okay, this dude is kind of like me. So these can be quite useful. So I mean, you might have people that they know how to take a shower, so you're facilitating a no response, but they don't like being told what they have to do. So you can just have a model there, sort of help with the facilitation. Prompt, guide, give a little cue that assists. You can use modeling to teach entirely new behaviors. Okay. This happens all the time with children, right? Teaching children how to like drink out of a cup. Okay? So, you want a drink? Yes? Nah. Nope, don't grab the cup like that. Hold the cup with two hands. Okay? Like this. Okay? You may even prompt a little bit by guiding. So, okay, so put the kid's hands around the cup. Hold it like that. Here, I'll help you. Okay, good. Yay. Okay? So you're modeling. You're guiding the behavior. You're showing it. All right? So teaching entirely new things. In behavioral therapy, you can extrapolate that into all kinds of other cases in behavioral therapy. If you've got patients that need to learn new skills, whatnot, again, take them through it. Show it. Find someone similar to them. Model the behavior. Demonstrate it. And finally, reduce or eliminate undesired behaviors. Okay, so show what negative things can happen when you engage the behaviors. You can model good behaviors. Try to reduce the bad behaviors. All kinds of things. So again, very, very useful in behavioral therapy as well. Now, one of the things that makes humans so especially, or makes observational learning so especially important in humans, is the fact that we have these things that are called mirror neurons. How many people have heard of these? A few people? Okay. Yeah, that's a bit more. A few years ago when I teach this stuff, it would be like in a class of 300, four people have heard of them. Okay, so we're getting a little bit better. Mirror neurons are particular neurons. They're scattered throughout the parts of the brain. So lots in the premotor cortex, lots over in the language-related centers, frontal cortex for empathy, pain. So they're all through. Basically, what a mirror neuron does is this is a neuron that will fire when the person performs an action or when the person observes somebody else performing that same action. Incidentally, it's not just people. A number of non-human species also have mirror neurons. Particularly, a lot of work has been done with primates. So a lot of primates that have been studied also definitely have mirror neurons. The closer you get to humans in terms of the taxonomic chart, the more mirror neurons we find in animals. So what we've got here is the mirror neuron seems to allow for quote-unquote mental imitation of observed behavior, things that are visually seen, and most of the original work was done with visual feedback, but also with auditory. So basically, what we've got here are neurons that are specifically involved in observational learning. These are neurons that specifically activate, they fire, and therefore strengthen synaptic connections by seeing a behavior or hearing a behavior, somehow witnessing, observing something being performed, something being done. These were discovered actually pretty much entirely by accident. Rizzolatti, Galese, and Fagasi back in 1995 were doing a very, very traditional neural electrical recording study. So they had macaque monkeys. They had electrodes implanted into the cortex. And what they were doing was they were just interested in mapping neurons in the cortex for things like reaching out and grabbing stuff, so which neurons are going to be involved. So perceptual, very perceptual feedback, traditional kinds of studies. Nothing wrong with that, okay. So what they do is they put a monkey on the, they put a monkey, a macaque into a little sort of chair restraint, and then they have a table in front, and they put a raisin somewhere on the table, and they have the macaque reach out, and the macaque wanted the raisin, so it would reach out and grab the raisin from different places, and, you know, which way the arm is going, which neurons are going to fire, that sort of thing. So somebody apparently walked in one day and said, so what you actually doing here? And one of the researchers said, yeah, okay, so, you know, imagine I'm the monkey that's sitting over there wired into all this, and we're just doing electrical recording, so if I'm the monkey, there's a raisin on the table, and we have the monkey reaches out, grabs the raisin, and eats it. Chunk, chunk, chunk. Wait a minute. What just happened? They'd left the monkey wired up while this was going on. The monkey, possibly a little bit hungrily, but the monkey observes the human researcher reach out, pick up the raisin, and eat it. The same neurons that were firing when the monkey reached out and grabbed the raisin fired when it watched the human do it. It's like, was that supposed to happen? It's like, no. Did the monkey's arm move? I don't think so. Try it again. So, you know, one person watches the monkey, see if the arm actually moves. You know, just, I put a raisin on the table. I'm the monkey. I reach out and pick up the raisin and eat it. Sure enough, the neurons fired. That's interesting. Monkey didn't move its arm. That's not supposed to happen, they thought. Start studying this. So that was the discovery of the mirror neurons. Quite accidental. If they hadn't just left the apparatus running, they wouldn't have gotten that. So sometimes, you know, nice little accidents happen like that. Anyways, so they published this in 96. Now, this work was being done with electrical recording in the premotor cortex. And so for the first few years, up until about 2000, the assumption, or maybe 2002, the assumption was that we were dealing strictly with motor neurons. But that's not actually the case. In humans, for example, studies have now shown that humans actually have way more mirror neurons than monkeys do. And we have them in more locations than macaques have them as well. So premotor cortex, involved in movement, things like the inferior parietal, so that's involved in issues of perception, other areas, posterior parietal lobe, superior temporal, sulcus, the insula. And insula is interesting. These here are parts of the brain involved in comprehending things like feelings, understanding intentionality, language use. So now think about the kinds of things that children are doing in the first few years of life. One of the massive things is language development. Ever notice that there was a very amusing Robin Williams sketch years ago, but ever notice that if you say something wrong in front of kids, if you swear or something, you know, that's what they're going to imitate? A friend of mine that was teaching English in Japan years ago and said usually the kids were good. We just had a class. The kids were just jumping off the walls, just driving her nuts, and she finally just yelled at them, "Shut up!" At which point, you've got like 30 little Japanese kids going, Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. And it's like, no, 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 shit.
Shut up. Shit. Shit.
Yeah. Oh, I probably shouldn't have been saying shit. Oh, I said it again. Oh, dear. Anyway, but, you know, imitators, they'll pick up the stuff you don't really want them to. But mirror neurons, right? These things, that's what they're evolved for. They're evolved to allow us to learn by observing. We didn't have dedicated neurons, this would be so much more difficult. This may, in fact, you know, explain a lot of issues, but not all species of animals are equally good at observational learning. Okay? The more social the species is, typically the more they'll utilize observational learning. Species which live very individualistic lives tend not to use those quite so much. Right? If you live in social groups to begin with, you can probably get a lot of information by watching others. We are a very social species. So, interesting little evolutionary process here. The mirror neurons are a system dedicated to learning through observation. It's not just about, as I said, it's not just about motor learning nowadays, but understanding of meaning or intentions for acting. You can get better at certain things. So, like, for example, you know, can you get better at golf by watching Tiger Woods? Can you get better at golf by watching golf? Yes, you actually can. This will strengthen the connections in the mirrors. What it won't do is give you the motor skills. It won't give you the muscle memory. So-called muscle memory. But it will help to lay down some synaptic pathways there in terms of, you know, watching swings, gives you an idea what a swing is really supposed to look like. You then need to actually practice this. But this also accounts, this can now serve to account, to explain and account for why a lot of people that do sports, like their coach will say, okay, before you, like, diving, right? Before you dive off the board, stand there, visualize. Or if you've got to sink a basket in basketball, okay, take a moment, visualize what's going to happen. Try to imagine as best you can how you're going to throw that ball or how you're going to start your dive. Okay? That kind of visualization, as it turns out, can activate mirror neurons. So you're exercising, if you will, some of these synaptic pathways. Definitely not limited to the motor responses. Galizzi, Rizzolatti, and colleagues, for example, had subjects listen to sentences that would describe an action. What they found was the same mirror neurons fired in the brains as they're listening to these sentences as would have fired as if the subject had done the same action themselves or had seen that action performed. So we're dealing now with this abstract. We're dealing with language at this point. So we've got abstract representation. The fact that we humans have so many of these mirror neurons may explain why, of all the species out there, why we're best at language. As we said a class or two ago, I mean, you can get some chimpanzees that have limited capacity in language, but they're not great at it. Okay? We seem to evolve specifically to deal with some of these things. Incidentally, there is some evidence that autistics may have deficits in mirror neurons. So this may help to explain why some of the behaviors that autistics have difficulty with maybe there. Okay, I will be here until about 2:15. If anyone wants to stick around and take a look at their midterm, if I don't have your fourth assignment yet, please give me that. Key for the third assignment is up on the website. Have a good weekend. Thank you.